Hey, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 282. If you watch Mandroid over the weekend, the Comedy Central special, I cannot thank you enough. I got to live tweet it from the Comedy Central Twitter account and then from mine as well. And I was so flattered and blown away by the positive response. For a second, I was like, wait, this is the internet, right? Everyone was so nice, and I really, really appreciate it. It just meant the world to me. So thank you so much if you watched a special. I'm sure they'll air it a bunch more times, and I think you can pre-order it on Amazon. And if you do, there's a very special bonus material. There's extra stand-up that was not in the special. And then also, I brought Mike Furman out to do a couple of songs just for the DVD. So that's the Mandroid DVD on Amazon. Pre-order now, I think, comes out in January, maybe. And speaking of hard and firm, we have a brand new song. New video coming out Tuesday, November 13th. So if you're listening to this after the 13th, go watch it now. YouTube.com/Nerdist is a very special video for a very special lady. So please go check that out. And I would like to thank this sponsor for the Nerdist Podcast, Stamps.com. So you might be saying to yourself, hey, I would like to have a postage meter to have all of my stamps. And you would be wrong for thinking that. Well, I guess not wrong, but there's a better way. So I guess that only makes you partially wrong, not 100% wrong. But stamps.com, you can print postage from your computer, and then you print it out, and you get the exact postage you want. So with a postage meter, you might have hidden fees. There's meter ink charges, reset fees, or a long-term contract, or extra hardware to buy or lease. Not with this, my friend, unless you consider your computer extra hardware. But you probably already have a computer, which is, I'm assuming, how you're listening to this podcast. Yeah, you could be listening to it on your phone. I don't know. I'll come assess your hardware later. But with Stamps.com, you can save up to 80% as compared to a postage meter. So don't waste money. Do it the inexpensive and easy way, Stamps.com. If you go to Stamps.com right now, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer of a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com and enter the promo code Nerdist. And now let's shift our focus to this episode. So a few weeks ago, my business partner Peter Levin is sitting on a plane, and the man who sits next to him is Eric Idle. And they talk the whole flight, and they hit it off, and it turns out Eric Idle, the nicest guy in the world. So Eric, they made this show earlier this year in Los Angeles at the Orpheum Theater. It was a live performance of a show called What About Dick? And the cast is insane. It's Eric and Russell Brand and Billy Connolly and Tim Curry and Eddie Izzard and Jane Leaves and Tracy Ullman and Sophie Winkleman. And so they shot the live shows, and they're putting it up as a download on Tuesday, November 13th, which they are calling Dick Day. And for like $6, if you go to whataboutdick.com, you can see one of these performances from this amazing cast. And it's sort of a hybridized, it's kind of a musical, but it's a little bit of a play. And Eric described it as a Downton Abbey, only funnier. So if you go to whataboutdick.com again, it's well worth the $6 to download this show. So Eric got Eddie Izzard and Billy Connolly and Sophie Winkleman all in one room, and we just talked, and it was I wasn't freaking out at the time because everyone was so cool that I just forgot for a second who they were and what they meant to me, and I was just talking to them like comedians, you know, just getting advice. And what it wasn't all stand-up talk, but there wasn't certainly an element of that. And I do want to make it clear that I'm not putting myself on the same level as these comics. So when we're talking about comedy, it's not like I'm going, yeah, we're all in the same boat. I am an amoeba. I am a baby comic compared to these guys. I just had my first special, as we talked about earlier. And again, thank you for watching if you did. But I absolutely was so honored to talk to these guys. And they had some incredible insights. And, you know, I mean, they're legends. These guys just mean so much to me individually, you know, just through my comedy development. And Sophie, who I wasn't super familiar with before, I'd certainly heard of her, totally held her own, was so funny, and was wonderfully charming. I think Jonah, though, was super nervous because he was actually sitting next to me the whole time. I do not think Jonah said one word during the entire podcast, which was adorable. So listen to the show. If you hear Jonah, tweet at me, because I don't think he actually said anything. But here we go, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 282. Eddie Izzard, Billy Connolly, Eric Idle, Sophie Winkleman, from whataboutdick.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We are gathered here together.
This is a very solemn occasion.
Yes.
Nice glasses.
Are we rolling?
Yes.
Oh, are you a Winkle?
Are you in New York, mate?
Winkle. I'm supposed to be in New York, but I've got no power or water. Or anything.
Yes. Oh, Hurricane Sandy came and blew him away, didn't he? But Sandy blew him off, didn't it?
Yes. Did you get an Amnesty International package from Martin?
No.
Thing.
Martin Lewis.
Martin Lewis.
Go on.
It's fucking hysterical.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's very, very good musically.
Excellent.
A lot of people singing Bob Dylan songs, including Pete Seeger singing Forever Young, and he's 91 when he's doing it.
Yes.
God,
he sent me that. I sent it back. I thought 91's certainly enough for Pete Seeger.
Of people saying how Martin wrong? Lewis is what a very...
I said 91 is too much Pete Seeger.
Every single one of the interviews says, Martin, my dear friend Martin Lewis. And I thought, they've all been tutored by that prick.
We're on podcast, and it's Abuse Martin Lewis Day.
I was about to cast my pod.
It's this wonderful man who works for Amnesty.
No, fuck that guy. Am I doing it right?
Yeah, fuck that guy. Yeah, fuck that guy.
Good to see you. Welcome.
I'm not officially here at the moment.
We're on one cast.
Welcome, Eddie, into the room.
I'm just wondering. It's a great view. That's a really nice view, Anne.
It's radio, Eddie.
Now, if you were, for people listening on the podcast, we are now looking out. We can see the Hollywood sign.
You can see the Hollywood sign. You can see the beach.
We can see a cross. We can see that sort of Rio de Janeiro.
And then the other side of the wall of smog. So it's a marine layer.
And out there, that looks like what it must have looked like years ago, you know, like before humans got here.
Yeah, pretty much.
It was just palm trees and oil. And religious people who were talking about. Which is the wrong religion, according to a lot of people who sued the Catholic Church.
Yeah, they don't think years.
And then Sam Goldwyn came, and he was called Sam Goldfish.
Goldfish, he was.
I thought you should have kept it, don't you? And he's a great name, Goldfish.
And the comedian should have gone to him and said, "You've got to change your name to Steve Goldfish."
That's a very old joke.
There we go,
Steve.
That's the one
to do. Eddie, I don't know if you remember, but I did Green Room with you in Montreal. With the Paul Provenza show.
No, I recognise you, but I just thought the background's changed, and then I go, I you know, because you meet people intensively.
Yes.
This is, I think.
I did Green Room with you in Montreal.
That was the first one. You did the first one?
How many people did you do Green Room with in Montreal?
No, it was you. That was the first time I actually sat down with the legendary myth. Are you beyond myth into legend? Python and yourself are beyond myth.
Thank you, Edward.
Me and Helen. No, we're not. We can't be a myth and legend, can we? But these two are myth and legends.
Who's
did
in
you bring
trouble?
An old-timey telephone?
But myth is bigger than legend. Legend has a
You've got to get iconic. You're iconic.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, you are.
Yes. You've got to get to iconic.
That's junior legend.
You're a legendary. Yeah, no.
Yeah, you're
iconic
legend.
Is an old legend. You know,
you have to die to get to myth, don't you? Because you
have to be dead for a lot of years to be myth. There has to be a lot of separation.
But you can be a living legend.
You can be a legend.
Yeah, you can be a legend.
You can be in your own lunch.
Legend in your own lunch.
But is myth even possible anymore? Because everything's so meticulously recorded. Is mythology even possible anymore?
Oh, these days, no, it's tricky, isn't it?
You know you're a legend when you get those weird prizes, the Lifetime Achievement Award and all those ones. Those ones you don't want. They're kind of saying, take this and bug it off. Stop irritating everybody.
Well, they didn't give it to Pete Seeger.
Can you retire? What's wrong with you?
What you said about Pete Seeger is, I don't want to hear it at 91, I want to hear it when it's 95. Now, come on, go. That shirt is, for regular listeners,
too loud.
It is louder than Hollywood.
I think it comes with an outside aerial.
It comes with a. As a transvestite man, I do feel your shirt is too loud. It's actually working against your face.
Only radio. It's just because the camera just walked in here.
Volume control.
You know, they're abusing my shirt.
Correct the colour balance.
Because I took it off because it was just radio.
Right.
And it wouldn't be noticed except by action transvestite.
That's the colours.
I would wear muted colours. Blood lipstick fighting. And as you can see, as I was explaining, this is my nails are saying British European transvestite. So that's political views and sexuality. And it took me 27 years to work out how to do that. It is, because I can actually do this and have a beard and it doesn't seem to bother people that much. Obviously, it'll bother people like Mary Whitehouse, who's a dead English woman who would have been very bothered. If you dug her up, would be bothered about it.
If you go to a grave and listen, you can hear her spinning.
You have the equivalent. It's like she was like a Republican.
She was an art teacher.
How could you teach art when you were so
exactly so uptight?
Did you see on the Python thing? There's a guy on that. I can't remember who it is. He calls it grandma blowjob. Grandma blowjob. And it's just such a. We didn't even think of that name, but she would. Whenever she got pissed off with Life of Brian, didn't she?
Absolutely.
Then it went through the roof. You wanted to get this woman pissed off. She was one of those people that if they were pissed off, all the cool people would come and you sorted.
Oh, that's fair. And what was her position in British culture?
Just a busybody.
Yeah, busybody.
Yes.
Yeah. Public busybody.
Complainer to the papers, a complainer about the BBC, always on the phone. And, yeah.
She was moral guardian.
Head of something called the Festival of
Voluntary
Light.
Voluntary moral guardian.
That's so nice of her to make everyone.
I was very grateful.
How's one make money doing that?
She actually looked like my mother. Spitting image. And once we were, it was Michael Palin's birthday, and we were on stage in Birmingham at the Hippodrome, and I got my mum to come on. And I grabbed Michael and said, now, Michael Palin's biggest fan, here she comes, Mary Whitehouse. And my mum came on with a cake and gave it to Mike. It's in the Birmingham Mail that Mary Whitehouse came on and gave him a cake for his birthday.
Because if you've got a certain look of a slightly more senior lady, they could be interchanged.
They were completely
but
sure.
But then she has to write into the paper and then denounce the cake at the same time.
Some people have aunts of a certain age who smell peculiar. and so they wear lots of perfume to cover up this peculiar odour, and it makes a third smell. That's what she was like.
It's like air freshener,
wine and roses.
And we didn't even know what she smelled like, but we could assume from watching her on telly that she smelled like the third smell.
That's a horror movie. You've just written
the third
a
smell.
Well, it's a real good time. It's not a horror movie. It's more like a worry movie. You're worried. You're watching. You're not come actually back. Horrified. You're just worried.
Pamela used to have an Australian expression for it, which I can't remember, but it was like vomit in the flower patch. Somebody's vomited in the petunias. It creates a third smell.
Yes. The third smell.
I think it's for people who put aftershave on their smelly socks. To create.
There are people who do that.
Jesus, I'd take it to a fine art, but that is.
No.
That's advanced. That's a badge on your scout uniform, isn't it? The spraying of stuff. There is the rotating.
Many years ago, I was a welder.
I'd like to think you were shaving your socks. And that's just what you did.
I didn't, but I used to shave my trousers when I was in the army.
Why?
Because it drove me insane, the jaggedy material.
Okay.
So I found the shirt as well. I shaved the inside of my shirt and the inside of my trousers.
Was this one of those tricks that they teach you in the army?
Yes.
How long were you in the army?
I was only a territorial. I only went on a Friday night. Came back in a Sunday.
You saw action. You were in
Cyprus.
Yes,
I did. The people shot at me.
Parachuted into Cyprus.
Yes, in Libya too.
You were parachuting?
Yes, I was in the parachute regiment.
Wow. Because I was trying to be a parent.
Well, yeah, well,
yeah, I did that. I'll show you a picture of me at 16. I tried to do a. It shows how serious I was in my head. But I wanted to be in the parachute particularly, and I was doing this special course in my holidays from the Combined Cadet Force. And, pretty serious.
Fucking A.
Were
the nails done out of frame?
No, I wasn't out. I wasn't out until I was 23. So, but I knew I was a transvestite. But that's part of my stand-up in Dressed to Kill. I talk about, you know, if you actually had a lot of guys and blokes being parachuted into different areas, everyone would go, "What the? Oh shit! They've cornered us! Oh, we were looking at the guys from Makeup, and we didn't expect."
And I'm sure you can do that.
So,
can we not? I was looking at other people.
I was the silver drummer in the band.
Wow.
Oh, Eddie.
So,
who knew?
which is a less good photo, but
there will always be a silver drummer.
Splendid.
To me.
Now that was an interesting story. That's a real sort of me story, because it was done in houses at a boarding school, and so the guy was in charge of the whole thing. The guy who throws that big twirly thing up in the air in the combined cadet force drum thing. He was in this house called Schoolhouse. I was in a different house, and so he wanted to give to his friend the silver drummer title, and you get these drumsticks with solid silver end bits, and I've been trying to get these my entire way, working my way out, and there's no way this guy was better than me, and I just went up to him and said, you're not fucking giving this gig to this guy. He's just not even going to test him against me. There's just no way he's better than me.
How dare you?
And then he said, well, and I made a brilliant compromise, because he had to stand on the top left position, and I said, okay, you stand top left, I'll stand top right, I'll have the drumsticks and you have ordinary sticks.
You were already working on billing in the middle.
No, I was working on compromise that worked my way. That was because who gives a shit here anymore? No one knew that guy's the important guy. It didn't really matter where you stood, as long as you're at a corner. And I did the paradiddle.
Oh, you know what paradiddle is, yeah.
I was doing the... When they all brought the sticks up, I was doing the bit in the middle.
Oh, nice.
So I was, military. That's why... Action Transvestites, they know about World War II. And this is why this ties into What About Dick, I think, because What About Dick is
flawless,
is the summation.
It's a shame, really, because...
Military, fucked up history, shirts that don't work, hell of a drawing.
My next door neighbour was a drummer, Ian Meikle. We lived in a tenement when I was a child. And he used to play on the sideboard. That's how I know it. Paradiddles and all that.
Yeah.
He was a drummer in a pipe band. Yeah. And in our house, my sister would be playing piano on our sideboard because we didn't have a piano. So she went to piano lessons on a Sunday and practiced all week on the sideboard. Oh,
silence. You can just draw keys onto the board.
Yeah, she drew it.
Yeah. You can do that. You can, as long as you know where the positions are.
So, and to this day, she can play, but only with music. If you take the music away, it's like, boom. Look, even Happy Birthday, she had the music. Da da dee da 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 dee da. Pull the page away.
The piano starts farting. That's
what
happens.
That's like a Tom Waits song, isn't it?
The piano man is farting.
You should talk about... I knew you were territorial, but you should talk about being parachuted into action, for fuck's sake.
I did many years ago.
You bring it back and talk again. Yeah. Was it in the reason? Because I've heard nearly everything you've done, I think, and I just hadn't... I knew that you were territorial, and I just didn't know parachuted into action.
That's when I discovered you can hear a bullet passing you.
Right.
I didn't know you could hear it going... Ugh. You know, if a guy is shooting across the valley at you as it passes you...
How close would that be? Just there?
Oh, no, about 12 feet or something.
Oh, well, if it's 12 foot away...
Yeah.
Did you ever
and if you don't hear it, you're dead.
Yeah.
did you ever kill anyone?
No, well, I shot at some people, but it was dark. It was black, pitch night.
So maybe.
So just boom, boom, boom. The whole point is shooting at people to keep their head down, not to kill them.
Okay.
And this really ties into What About Dick?
Because you want to hear it. You want to hear it.
Yeah, I think that death is people
Dick
die.
Is dead.
People do die. Bluted to death.
Yes, there's a lot of death. And this kind of badinage is what we put into it. And we wanted this kind of murder death. Attack, parachuted in, shirts.
Patriotism.
I think we need to hear Sophie's.
Sophie Winkleman.
In the army. You know, no, please don't.
Not me.
No,
I'm
Sophie.
Talking
got a
come on, I'm going to
voice.
Admire.
She has a good singing voice, but sometimes the timing.
You were wrong about the timing. He made me all nervous about
He's often
writing.
Wrong, but he's very pushy.
No, I was right about the timing. You were jumping ahead on a thing.
Okay, I remember the bus.
But actually,
they're pushy.
Italian men are gorgeous.
They eventually all together
way
quite a lot.
For they make me slightly gorgeous when I read of them. Romeo.
That breath is correct.
See?
But
that's
before,
how I did it.
No, but you wouldn't take the breath. You'd go straight in. You'd go. And you would flip in a beat. You would go ahead.
Sophie, he's trying to take your silver sticks right now.
I'm a silver drummer. And Eric, you did
so now I'm in struggle.
It was syncopation, Sophie. It was syncopation.
I thought she sang
the light. But I watched it.
Yeah.
I watched the show back and they've edited you.
No, they have not.
They cut away from your face and then they come back to you.
Edward, it wasn't that
he's
howling.
He's jealous of your tits.
I am jealous of your tits. That is called breast envy.
William.
At some point, we have to get to the point.
I think, Sophie, you're jealous of your tits.
That's how amazing.
What am I supposed to say
I'm
about?
Not sure.
How are the girls supposed to respond?
Yeah, so I'm very proud
of
her.
Look coy. Yeah. I'm jealous. Yeah. Let's talk about Billy's nails. Come on. That's bad.
No, I think.
Oh, you're ready.
Nails. No, actually, I want to talk about Billy's nails.
I'm jealous of his nails because I play the banjo and I play a style where you called frailing or clawhammer that you play with your striking down with your nails and mine break and smash to bits. But he has tree climbing quality nails.
No. I have attack monster type. I worked out before Stone Age. We must have been just going in there, just like animals do. Animals, you know, tigers don't come up with a rock and go, got this guy. You know, tigers, opposable thumb, obviously, doesn't matter. They could do it with two paws, and they'd have to run on their hind legs.
But even dropping that would have to be a properly shaped stone for them to be able to clasp it in their paws.
You can push quite a lot of things together. I know we could do experiments on this, but...
But then they'd be running on their face, well, because they'd need these hands. Well,
either way, it'd be adorable.
No, they'd use their legs.
They really would be.
Just to tiptoe up there. Poof. But no, I think that's good for attack, but tree climbing is more good for grip. It's the grip. You don't need the end bits.
Well, it's the tree climbing quality. You need that thickness.
And we did 2 million years ago. We would have been doing this in a tree. This
podcast in a tree.
And we would have been saying
3 million.
And then we would have been.
Happened to have done a song with Professor Brian Cox, and we have the date down to 3 million. Well, we left the trees 3 million years ago.
I just did a documentary on genetics, and I was with Professor Jim Wilson, who said it was 2 million. So, Brian Fox, Professor Jim Wilson.
1.5 million.
Now, they found a new baby, which little old, we went back into the trees. We were able to stand up and walk, and they felt that we didn't actually leave the trees for quite some time afterwards. We would go back.
But it's about a piano, basically. There's a piano involved.
Yes.
And it used to be in the original title. What was it?
The remains of the piano,
which attracted me to the show, was then cruelly whipped away and became a sort of dirty title. What about Dick? And where's Dick? And how's your Dick?
And there are one or two
suggestive songs.
Suggestive songs.
And then a bit of racism to make the Scotsman misunderstood.
I said to Eric, and I think Eric backed me up on this, there were not quite enough Dick jokes. In two more, we would have had quorum.
There is a mathematical number where it is out.
Perfect, and that's when you can work out when the Big Bang.
There's a Dick quotient. Yeah, there is definitely a Dick quotient.
There's one or two Dick jokes in there, but you had to. Once you had that title,
some of them have been pulled back.
Oh, have they?
Improved and a little. We've circumvented a few of the Dick jokes.
Circumcised.
You play banjo with like Steve Martin and Kevin Nealon and you're like in a banjo club.
Yeah, well,
yes, I play a fucking guitar with him. It's so boring. You go ding dong 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 ding dong. You know, and you play C and G if you're a guitarist.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
The nitty gritty dirt band, McEwen, he's there as well.
Oh, shit.
They're all geniuses.
He's the McEwen. Is he the one that produced all of Steve's albums in the 70s? Wayne McEwen.
Well, no, he's not Willie McEwen. What's his name? What's McEwen's first name?
Ian.
He was the banjo player in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Gotcha.
It was his brother that was Steve Martin's manager.
That guy, okay.
He was at school with him in Orange County. Yeah.
Are you performing in New York? Well, I mean, obviously not performing in New York now, but you were.
In December.
You were performing there in December.
Yes.
Are you doing any stand-up anytime soon?
Yeah, I'm developing my new show, which is called Joe had a French title so that when I go to France they go, oh yeah, let me see what it's called.
You do the shows in French as well.
To the spectacle en français, yeah.
I would, but they I don't like the French.
German,
they ran away from the Germans, the French, you know.
Do you find that the ultimately, if you have a comic's brain, can you pretty much take it in any language? Or how much cultural subtlety do you have to understand?
All you need to do is just have your references. Python is a perfect example of this. So Life of Brian, you translate that into French or subtitle it in any language or dub it, and it will work everywhere, even places that wouldn't know about Christianity. You can work it out. you could work out the stuff that had to go on. Some of the jokes might get lost in that, but all the words make sense. It's human stuff. What have the Romans ever done for us? Are they give us this, that, and the other? You just got to have a certain sensibility about knowing that the Romans made a lot of shit happen, and we're an oppressed people, but actually some of this stuff's kind of good. Just like they say in Nazi Germany, a German friend of mine, Michael Mittermeier, has just been playing
Britain. I know.
Michael Mittermeier has been playing now in English in Britain, and he says, there's, you know, the Autobahn going at whatever speed on the Autobahn, can we just keep that one? You know, after World War II, when they were trying to denazify everything except the Autobahn, and a very fast third lane, we like that. And
I thought Germans drove so fast on Autobahns because they were all desperate to piss. From drinking that all that beer, you know?
Oh, it is big things of beer.
Trying to get to these stations where you can piss.
I think there's an illegality of.
But if you need close, no, you'd find most of them cross-legged.
I think it's fine. Eric, you're a sweet guy, and it's amazing to me that you are not, like, of anyone in this room. You must have the most people running up and quoting shit at your face. Like, they see you in public and they shout out Python quotes.
Yeah.
Are you okay with it, or do you just like,
Well, what do you do?
I don't know.
You go, yeah.
That's right.
Hi. Yeah. You know, I mean, you can't do anything, can you?
It is, there's nothing one can say. It's a cake or death to me, and I go,
yeah. You know, so, quite.
And if they shout out in the show, you just go, I don't know. No, it's,
they don't shout at me because I look angry all the time. They're scared of me.
But you, because you, well, you really.
They
like,
used to shout for things. They used to shout for the
command
in the early days. Yeah, they did. They'd shout for bits of your routine. I remember being there.
Yeah, Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah, and then there was the crucifixion.
Crucifixion.
It was very popular.
I remember hearing early. I got early Billy records out, and I couldn't. Your Glaswegian accent was so strong, or my ear wasn't tuned in enough.
Yes.
Because your accent has come down a bit, but my ear is tuned in because it was so strong. It's windy. Windy's going through.
I had the same experience. I was in, like, I think maybe 96. I was driving from London to Edinburgh, and I'm like, oh, I got a Billy Connolly tape. And I listened to it, and I was trying to work. I knew it was funny, but I couldn't. My American brain couldn't sort out all of the words from one of the earlier albums.
Yeah. Do you know, sometimes it's rhythm. It's not just the accent itself. Sometimes it's a rhythm. And we don't move our mouths that much in Scotland. We don't move our lips all that much when we're speaking. You know, it's, people find it's quite difficult to understand.
Yeah. How do you still... Because how long have you been doing comedy now?
I don't know.
Okay, so...
12 years.
I don't know, what time did I come in?
But most people, why do you think most comics, like, after maybe 25 years or 30 years, they just stop? Do you think they lose the hunger to be on stage, or do they get scared or whatever? Because you're still doing it, and I find that amazing that you're still able to be relevant.
I don't know, sometimes they get fed up. And sometimes, so I've often looked at Chuck Berry, who did all that, you know, Johnny B. Good and all that, and O'Carroll. And then stopped and said, did my ding-a-ling, and then didn't do any more. You know, but what made him stop that great stuff? Or Robert Klein seems to have chosen to stop.
But he came back, he had a comeback.
Maybe I don't have any right to say that. Maybe he's doing great things somewhere else. But it seemed to me he sort of chose to stop.
I think there's a hunger has got to play a part in it. So you're hungry, you're starving. Yeah, you've chosen this profession that either... you know is tricky, or your parents, middle-class parents, are telling you this is very tricky.
Sure.
So you are struggling your way through. You're desperate to get something to work, and the furiousness of working all day. If they say, okay, we've got to work 25 hours a day today to get this thing sorted out, that's what you will do. And if you start making it and it starts going well, and there's people and there's fans say, hey, it will turn up at the next one, you find you can get away with stuff that isn't so good, and then you can get into this place where you're reading the phone book out,
But it's not really that it isn't so good. You get away with stuff that you wouldn't have the last time, because they now like what you do and are prepared to sit for longer and wait for something coming through. And then you can't bear to be with people who don't know you, because you don't have the luxury of floating and inventing.
Right. But then also, do you ever like to just show up where people aren't expecting and kind of...
I've never done it in my life.
No?
No, I don't do it. That's Robin Williams.
there's an interesting thing there, because I can't do that in the clubs. In the clubs, they do want this speedboat kind of stuff where you're going, hey, this, that, the other. Whereas the floating thing that Billy's talking about is beautiful, because you can go and you can just float around a bit, say something that's not... inconsequential, and then you go, oh, what about this? And suddenly you've got an idea. Out that the bridge.
From it, you branch off and you remember something. Or?
The difference between self-indulgence and great and inspiration. Indulgence and inspiration, they're right on the edge. And you've got to be indulgent in order to think of the stupid idea. Oh my God, that is a great idea.
Sure.
Or maybe it just continues to be a stupid idea. And that is the weird thing.
Sometimes miracles happen. I was at a place in Scotland called Straven. I had been in a band with Jerry Rafferty and Tam Harvey.
Jerry
Rafferty. Yeah, and we split and we all went solo, and we were called the Humble Bums. And I was in this room in Straven being a solo act and trying to be funny and stuff. And there was a big bay window with a curtain on it. It was a lounge bar above a public bar. And the people were all sitting there. And somebody said, what happened to the Humble Bums? And I said, fuck the Humble Bums. I'm super bum. And I ran over to the curtain and I opened it and lightning flashed. And something, and I remember in Sheffield going, shh, to the crowd, shh, and they all went, and I went, and a glass broke. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just pointed in the air and shh, a glass smashed in the floor.
And then you have to do that every night. You have to figure out.
Well, you can't do the same thing, but if you push yourself, weird things occur.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same verbally. If you just take your time, don't panic. Try and relax, which is extremely difficult when 3,000 people are staring at you. They've paid quite a lot of money.
But they're also, if people come, if 3,000 people pay to see you specifically, they're already on your side.
Well, that's the thing he's talking about, was before. And so you kind of begin to lose an edge of creativity and think, this is quite good.
No, I think you get a different kind of creativity.
Yeah.
But with all of you, and let's start with Eric, when people have a certain expectation of you, like, you know, people define in their mind what you're supposed to be. And sometimes they don't give you a lot of leeway with that. So when you try new things or you move on to other things, you know, like when you move past Python and stuff, how do you continue to engage them, or how do you get beyond that?
Well, I mean, that's 30 years ago, Python. You know, we haven't done anything for 30 years. So I've been doing it for quite some time. Yeah, absolutely. People go, oh, no, no, no. You live together. You live next door to each other. You're on the phone. No, it's 30 fucking years ago, you know. Yeah. So it doesn't bother me anymore, because it's so part of a different part of life that I've spent so many years being here doing other things.
That's
you know, mainly writing is what I do. I like to write things. They're different from these two, because they both stand up. They go into a room and they face the audience and they talk.
But also with solo. I mean, because you were Humble Bums and then it's you, and I was with a four-person group at college, dragged one of them down to London and was a two-person double act. Then I went solo because he was on holiday. And it's true. Rob, my partner, knew that. He said, you went on holiday. I said, I can't work if you're on holiday. What can I do? I'm just sitting here. I can't do anything. So I thought, I'll do a street show on my own. And I did one street show, made 10 quid. And I went, oh, 10 quid.
Didn't have to split it.
Yeah. No.
Well, I remember.
And I thought I could do six in a day. And I could make 16.
I remember, dude, Eric Idle, I'm pointing at, he asked me about stand-up. You were going to go out on tour with a band, and you said, I think I'm going to try a bit of stand-up. I said, do it. Just go and talk. You're entertaining. You're funny. There's no reason why it shouldn't work. And I remember when you phoned and said, it worked. And I was dancing a wild jig on my phone.
I talked to him too. In fact, I met him in Boston. He kept giving me tips.
Well, had I known you were going to talk to him, I wouldn't have told you.
Well, no, I know. With my tips. I said, you should try it. Fuck off.
You know, it was interesting. The first experience I've ever had of just going out and not knowing what you're going to say. Yeah. You give yourself a little bit of time. And, of course, you think of something to say, and then they laugh, and you think of something else to say. It's the laughs that give you the time, isn't it?
Yes.
To go on and pick it up.
And the more you do, I mean, the confidence, I think, my stand-up style is stolen from Billy Connolly, and all my surreal characters interacting is stolen from Python, so I'm a mixture of these two.
And your fashion is stolen from Sophie.
Yeah. His makeup is stolen from Sophie.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Sexism, tactic, makeup.
I couldn't agree more.
I'm trying to get you to speak.
Yeah.
You know. She's a funny person.
I'm admiring you all. And what do you do after a show? What do you both do after a live show?
I do accounting. I did. There's one
thing. I whinge and moan.
I used to get really excited about going off and doing accounting. I just did it once. It was the Edinburgh Festival, and the accounts were needed to be done for the venue that was happening. And I'd worked out how to do a spreadsheet, so I was in love with the spreadsheet because I come from a mathematical background, and there's mathematics involved in comedy. Would you not agree?
Yes,
you don't
algebra.
Go into accounting.
Yeah, it's algebra.
It is.
Yeah. Bollocks.
No,
it's such bollocks.
And Mozart would agree with this. Because there's music involved.
What does he know about algebra? That's when he was born, you fool.
Mathematics is involved in the music thing, the repetition of the notes thing. And in comedy, there's a magic three, which can be a magic four, magic five, or magic six even, if you do it. There's not a huge amount of rules, but magic three is one of them. You establish, you recommit, and then you twist it. On the third, he was an idiot. You know those ones. But you do them naturally.
You don't go off and do accounting after every show. Tell me honestly what you do after a really good show, and you come off stage and you've been in front of 3,000 people. Genuinely,
I
what do you?
I shoot heroin into the left eyeball, and then it was really big. And then I just
stop it. Tell us the truth.
I don't know. There's nothing planned, but it's not quite like I go and find televisions to throw. I throw them into hotel rooms. That's
drag them up the lid.
Well, what do you do, Sophie?
After a big show?
Yeah.
After a big live show? Mm. I haven't done one for ages. Apart from yours.
Exactly.
I mean, apart from yours.
You did this.
I did this. I thought you were talking about stand-up.
Didn't we go and party?
We had drinks every night after the show.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, and touring, if you can get a little party going after each touring thing. I mean, I was never the person who went out the nightclub, hey, I'm going to pull the birds and fuck nine people. And that was just never going to be me.
I don't know if any comic has ever done that.
No, it's
more than
the rock. Oh, shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you add all the pythons together, we have, you know.
But
what do you do with all that adrenaline?
I tell you what was great.
It actually goes away if you allow it to.
Is it?
It was my wife taught me to do it.
Is it sort of, you go...
Yeah, instead of going further, higher. Because I used to come off stage and my roadie would have a gin and a joint.
Yeah.
And then hand them to me and I would go, oh, great. Let's go somewhere! Let's go and do something! And then we'd go on, and then I'd... I remember, and I was tired of waking up in double rooms between the two beds with all my clothes on, wondering where I'd been. I thought I'd better stop this.
But don't you think when you're on the road, especially if you're doing like, you know, six shows in a weekend, and then by the fifth or
Hang
sixth
on, six shows at the weekend.
Six shows in a weekend, yeah. Like in a club, not like
Oh right, because we never that's more an American thing than we tend to just do one a night or no, maybe a couple a night in the clubs. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't like doing two. I always do something in the second one that I've done in the first one. I say, oh God, I've said this before. And you did, it was in the last show.
I was totally against him. I've just changed my mind recently.
Do you ever feel...
money?
No, just because I'm coming up with a new show. So I found that if I did two in a night, even if it's a small audience, it's only 50 people coming, and I do one at 8, one at 11... like I'm going to do tomorrow night, then I can try out new things and then try out another new thing. You know that thing when you go through and think, oh, that's a nice idea, and then you can try it out immediately next.
Yeah.
When you're building a new hour, because I'm going through it now, do you sort of have an overall theme? Even though obviously you set a title for the hour. Do you have an overall theme that you want to explore? Or do you go, well, I have some ideas and I'll just get on stage and riff and see how it all
comes
together?
Second one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm trying to make it link through force of nature. Translation out, or it could be act of God, but maybe that's the difference between us on the world. Are we all forces of nature, or are we just acting under acts of God? That is the question for humanity.
And is that's going to be the ultimate?
That's what I've just made up as being. I realized that there was this thing people saying, oh, that means act of God. And I'm saying actually it means force of nature as well, and you can be your own force of nature. Hopefully, anyone performing has to bring a certain force of nature to it. If you're stacking shells, less. And that is the thing. We used to all believe in gods, and now there's a billion of us who are not believing in gods, and it's the fastest growing non-religion in the world, outstripping Catholicism. I don't know that. I'm just pretty sure.
Do you think clear air turbulence is the atheism test?
Which clear air?
Clear air turbulence.
Oh God!
Oh jeez, get me down here! I'll buy a rosary.
And it's just the guys up front doing that with the control. Let's get them going.
Atheist, I'll give you.
And they're all sitting in a gyroscopic thing that doesn't move while they do that. Everything else is bouncing on the plane.
They're cupped in the hands of God, and then the rest of the plane.
I spoke to an air steward on a Qantas. It had been like this for about 3/4 of an hour. You know, and we were all quite used to it. Nobody was scared. It was just kind of irritating. You couldn't write or anything. And I said, and I got talking to him about turbulence and the worst he had ever experienced. And he said he once delivered all the meals to the whole deck of, what was that, 150 people. And then the plane went, woof, woof. And every meal went back one row, you know, like upside down. The soup and pasta, and custard. Oh shit! Jam in your hair, honey on your jacket, and he went round the whole thing and cleaned it all up. And he went, at the end of the voyage, he went up to the captain with his thing and he said, severe turbulence, could you verify it for me? And the captain said, well, that's not severe turbulence. He said, that was moderate turbulence. Severe turbulence is when we can't see the dials.
Oh, shit.
When they can't read the dials up in the front there, like that. So I've never experienced that, but I've been in plenty of the gadumph once.
Yeah, I wouldn't be. I mean, I used to hate flying, and then at a certain point I was like, well, I'm going to be a comic, I kind of have to get over it, and now it doesn't bother me so much anymore.
It's like Bumpy Road. You know, you sometimes get on a Bumpy Road for 45 minutes, and we don't go, oh my God, this is the end of, it's just a Bumpy Road, so.
I've got an earnest, quite unfunny question. Do you think really brilliant stand-ups like you all share something that is actually quite serious, like a serious, I don't know, like a serious personality trait makes you go and be brilliant stand-up, something from a childhood or something? Earnest question.
I think
I don't know, I think there's something weird, maybe you'll agree with me, Eddie, that makes you want to do it twice. Like, if you do it once, it should be enough for anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like
that makes
the Abbott
you carry
Hall
on.
Standing up on their feet, cheering you, this should do you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But you have to go on and do it the following night again.
And then whatever your last show was is how I think how you take away the experience. Like, you think you have 5 amazing shows and then 1 shitty show, and then you're like, this is not going well. I mean, I don't know. That's.
But I think it's all born of darkness.
I think all
humour and comedy is born of darkness.
I don't seem to be that far. There's a lot of very pissed off comedians who've got a dark side, and I don't seem to have that.
I don't mean the guys who are doing dark stuff on stage. I think,
but in their lives,
I think the thing that drives you to do it,
what's that?
Can be troublesome.
I think
trouble in your childhood. Maybe you were picked on at school. Maybe you were bullied. Maybe you were I don't know anything that's been troublesome and seemed endless.
Is there a genetic thing? Because my brother and father have got the same sense of humour. Did you and your families have anyone with the same sense of humour?
I had uncles who were funny guys.
But I think it's to do more with parental abandonment. It's maternal abandonment, and it starts very early that makes people funny. And when I took Lily to school at first, I could tell which kids in the class were funny. It was very interesting. They were right there. They were the funny guys, and they always remained the funny guys through the years as they all grew up. And so I think it's very early that you become the funny one. Well, that's the psychological, the psychiatric reason they say. But I think any kind of deep disturbance, abuse, or being stuck in a boarding school for 12 years, or, you know, there are. I think those are darkness is very.
Oh, I thought you said short.
Being a short person.
Being shot, that can do it.
Or a tall person,
short.
Like Cleese.
That's what I thought you said.
Or a very tall person, like Cleese. I mean, way taller than anybody else.
It does destroy, the power of a line, a word, can, in a classroom, can totally to send it into uproar, get people looking over to, or do you just feel this kind of, God, you know, heroicness of doing it? I do remember trying, and I was doing it for girls, because girls re-arrived at my school at 16, one girl for every 20 boys, and there was a terrible imbalance, so all the sporting guys were saying, hey, let's go out, and they were all going out with girls, and then there's a lot of boys just doing nothing, and a lot of boys going around helping girls lift things and stuff, and I thought, I'm not going to do that, so I'm just going to sit at the back of the chemistry lesson with a Dr. Edmondson, who wrote at a certain speed that left monkeys, not monkeys, gaps, you know, he just left pigeons. Hey, sodium chloride is a vegetable, it's not a vegetable. He did, he had the perfect speed for me to go, and that one. And I actually actively thought, this can really improve. One, the fact that girls, by the summer term, were going, I didn't even know you existed until.
Okay, I really think the common denominator seems to be like some sort of a need for attention to pull people's attention. Right? In your case, it seems like, oh, it was a good attention for positive reasons for girls. For other people, it could be attention for, I didn't get attention when I was a kid, and I need to feel loved in some way.
Yeah.
And so you have to.
But I think it actually starts while you're still a kid.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I there's a lot of people now say, oh, I decided to do stand-up for a while, and I don't understand that. I did it because I had to do it.
Yeah.
I'd been to see variety theatre, what you call vaudeville in America, and I had an aunt who loved it, and we'd go and see all these tenors, you know, and Liberace and people like that, but I would just wait for the comedian to come on. And I thought, God, I'd love to be one of them. And the more I saw them, the more I wanted to be one.
Well, can I ask you on that? Then music came before the...
Well, there was nowhere to do it. By the time I got the age I'd left school and had become a welder and stuff, I was all hairy and beardy. And so I wasn't available for cabaret. They wouldn't hire people who looked like me.
Is that in the 60s?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they eventually did, you know, when I dyed it and wore weird satin clothes and all that, let me in.
But it came through music. But did you actively do music thinking, well, you obviously loved the music.
And
then you just realised in the gaps, you could say, there's a thing I'd just like to point out. And I mean, I just...
No, I actually read in the paper that I was a comedian. I thought I was a funny folk singer.
Oh, right.
I'd always wanted to be a comedian. And comedy was really difficult to get into because there was hardly any of it anywhere in Scotland. There were hardly any social clubs or cabaret places, and the vaudeville was dying. So I was doing the folk music circuit and playing my banjo, and most banjo songs are about chicken pie or murdering your girlfriend. So you can be, there's bags of room to be funny.
Don't you think it's easier to be the funny guy in a music venue than the music guy in a comedy venue?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, very, very much so. Except it isn't easy to open for a rock band.
Oh, no.
Because I've done it. I'd opened for Elton John, Elvis Costello. Oh, God.
Because it's cool. Music is cool. At the cool age, it's cool. And I've done those mixed gigs. And the cool people sitting at the back of a venue somewhere around King's Cross in London. And the idea that you come on and say something funny, there's just no way that they could go... Not to just... You know, they've got to dismiss it for the fun. I'm not going to laugh at this guy because it'll fucking ruin my whole attitude that I have this evening with my cigarette and my girlfriend. You know, it's just not going to work.
Well, what about you, Eric? I mean, because was a lot of your stuff live first? Did you come together as a group of writers to make a television show?
Well, we come from a writing background. We were all writers. We wrote for Frost Report and David Frost. And we come from the Footlights, really, which is writing and performing. You write sketches and then you do it. So they were very close and connected at Cambridge, and the Footlights.
Where the spies come from.
Yes. Spies and comedians.
Spies and funny people.
Yeah. Some of them are from Oxford, too. I mean, you know, Sophie's Cambridge Footlights, too. But same background.
Are you really?
Yes. You'd shut up for a minute or two, you'd hear what she has to say.
No, but the whole thing about comedians is jumping over each other and saying, I'll tell you how funny I was. Backstage at the Comedy Store in London was people just getting their comedic cogs out, basically. Because no one actually sees you be funny off in another club. You say, I just tell you how funny I was. And you go, I did this, and then someone else goes, no, that's no good. I was better. It's such a weird thing that would happen in that. But it's funny just riffing off And somebody once told me the hardest gig they ever did is backstage at the Comedy Store, because if it didn't work, if the funny bon mot that you threw in didn't work, it's he's a dickhead, you know, and you die amongst your peer group. And that was but I loved that. I loved hanging out with stand-ups, which was I don't know if you came through a comedy writing thing.
But we never had stand-ups. I mean, we're pre-stand-ups, really. The only person who stand-up was Billy for all those years, really. Yes. There's not many at all.
And I was out there with all the fascists.
Yeah, we were doing...
You're the godfather.
We were we're sketch comedy. Sketch comedy goes on, and then it went on to television.
Comedy was the rage.
And then it stopped at the end of about, you know, what was that, 9 o'clock news is probably the last sketchy... I mean, it's
but then Fast Show came back. It went out and then came back with that Fast Show and others.
So, but then it moved very much into, you know, it wasn't cool to be Oxford or Cambridge.
No, yes, it's definitely not cool to be Oxford or Cambridge. You've got to live that down.
So, yeah. So, because but that was like around the 80s, right?
Yes, the 80s, it's been uncool ever since the Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry won the Perrier, the first ever Perrier. Uh-huh. And that was just at the time when it was not cool to do that, and then they just tried to live that down and say, well, actually, we're running the footlights. And I don't know if they actively did that, but I felt I was desperately trying to get to the footlights. Where you guys got to was where I was trying to get to.
Sacha Baron Cohen told me the day before, he said, I went to Cambridge because I wanted to be a member of the footlights. Mm. He said, I auditioned 3 times, they never accepted me.
Wow, didn't
extraordinary. No, he didn't get in.
Shit, I tried to go there, and then I realized I wasn't cool. And so I thought not working might make me cool at school. So I started doing that actively.
That's so funny. You basically have a group of comedic performers who come together because the rest of society doesn't accept them. And then within that, they in turn don't accept someone. And that forces them to rebel. Yes. And then they come up with
If you're the mainstream of the footlights, you know, it was certain people. You guys were going to get through whether you're the footlights or not. Because in Oxford, they didn't have the footlights. And
they had the equipment, though. So
but not, they didn't have the drinking thing in the club.
Not the drinking thing, no.
They had to build their own doodahs, didn't they?
They did.
But when, at Sheffield, I had to build all my own doodahs. I had to build the thing. I had to go to Edinburgh. I got to Sheffield University and said, I'm here to do the Edinburgh Festival. I'm just doing it. Basically, I was doing a degree because my dad said I had to do one. And that's why I was doing accounting there. And I said, I'm here to go to I go to Edinburgh. Whatever you do, I'll sweep up. I'm not trying to push my way in, but I could be very helpful. I've got a lot of energy. And they said, we don't go to Edinburgh. I said, the whole reason I'm here is to go to Edinburgh. I can't have this. And this very cool guy who I've met up since then, and Brad Scott, and he was just saying, you know, we no one goes. But someone went a few years ago and lost a lot of money. That's the whole fucking point of life, surely, is to go to Edinburgh. That's where it happens. So I started hitching up to Edinburgh and doing my first... I set the first show up myself, and I set all the first three up myself.
But where did you do them? What theatres?
You see, what the footlights were in... they'd been in for about 20 years, and they had all these people... They were sold out for the first day that the tickets went on sale. I was in Brodie's Tavern. The Celtic Lodge.
Deacon Brodie's.
Upstairs. I was on a 12 noon show in Deacon Brodie's, which is the Celtic Lodge opposite Brodie's Tavern. And 12 noon, and we were on there. And later on, I met a guy who ran the venue. He said, yeah, your show was shit, wasn't it? And he said that to my face. And it actually was. But I do have a very slow learning curve. The beginning bits are already rough, and then slightly better. But yeah, it was just rough. We had one redeeming sketch in it, but the rest of it was just garbage. And then the second year was slightly better. The third year was slightly better.
When did you all sort of figure out? When did you start to figure out? Like, oh, this is who I am, and this is where I write from. And like, there's a certain point where comics sort of become their point of view is so solidified that I feel like, you know, I could tell you potato chips and you would start talking about potato chips and it would just come as this sort of prepackaged, like...
It's a sort of organic process. It just comes itself. You don't realise it's there until it's there. You think you're doing the same. Have you ever... The best comparison I can think of is learning a tune from someone. I'm a banjo player, and I've often learned a tune from a record from some hero, Clarence Ashley or somebody. And I'll play it for a year, and then I'll play the record again. And the thing I'm playing is nothing like the thing I learned from him. But I thought that's what I was playing. Well, comedy is like that. You go on, you think you've said the same thing as you said last night, but you're not saying it. The audience has changed. The room has changed. You have changed. It's raining. It's not raining. It's windy. You've had bad news. You've got the flu. You say it slightly differently, and and it all every night there's a little chip comes off it, a piece is added to it, and it becomes Lego, sort of comedy Lego. And
it's the DNA of comedy.
Yeah, there's slight mutations. Yeah, it is like DNA. Slight mutations. And I worked out that...
Because my whole career has been... I've never written a word of it.
You've never written it down?
I've never written it down. I've written it down afterwards to try and remember it. But I don't write it. I add to it.
It's conversational stand-up. It's like a conversation you have, and they think, fly fishing. And then you go off on fly fishing, and then next night you say, I was talking about fly fishing. And then you go, and you say, what the fuck did I say about fly fishing? And then you go through, and
then you say, I was talking about fly fishing, and this guy at the back shouts, blah, 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 and boom. And suddenly you're away onto something else. Yeah.
It's also not always about material. Being on stage with these two, Billy could just suddenly, occasionally get the giggles, and the audience would find it unbelievably hilarious. Eddie had to just blink, and the whole audience was weeping with laughter.
Like, he's solid as a rock doing funny stuff, but when it's funny, you have a little look
across. That's my favourite parts of the film.
Which one?
It's when Eddie's going to do a dine of his own. He'll lean back and look at me.
He'd
say the line. And then he'd lean back again for my reaction.
There was a whole mini thing going on, which is almost subtext for that whole Python relationship. If you look between the six, the ideas of who could do... John Cleese said, at a certain age, I didn't want to have to be... Somebody tell me I can't do this material. So as a standard, someone who'd come up through a sketch... thing and worked out amongst four people how which sketches we were going to do, which lines we were going to do, and then getting to the place where you stand up and you say, I'm just going to say whatever I want.
Right.
And then there were certain nights that I thought, I think this line is better, and I'd say them, and sometimes they weren't, sometimes they flew. What did I say? The Queen of Sweden came
to someone. And there's a wonderful moment when Russell goes and starts off and he loses it. He's got nothing. He's abandoned on stage. He's with you. Those are the moments where you always would nail a line. You know, you'd always...
I was a hunter seeker for a line.
But it was very interesting because we've got nine people, about four or five of them are stand-ups, together on stage. And it was interesting to see the reaction because it wasn't
because a lot of people think it was kind of a lot of people think we're in constant competition.
Exactly,
love each other
because you're comedy fans. If you're a comedy nerd, you love comedy.
The best example was at my house.
And you're on the precipice together.
I have a house in Scotland, and I used to invite Eric Idle and Robin Williams and Steve Martin and all these guys, and we'd all be sitting having dinner. Eddie is out. We'd be having dinner, and. And you could see people being kind to one another. You would see Robin going off on one, he'd go off on some riff, and it would tail off. And one of us would go bloop, throw something in to bring it up.
Absolutely, that's what I like about comedians. You always
keep the
ball going.
We're often mistaken for people who are deeply envious and jealous.
You keep the ball alive.
But it is a gladiatorial thing. It's like how gladiators.
We like to impress one another.
We're verbal gladiators. So, like, gladiators must have had some sort of, hey, this guy's good at killing, I'm good at killing, and we're going to live and hopefully not die as slaves. And we had a similar thing to this. But if someone isn't good and you don't like them, then you don't care about them dying. But if you had a respect amongst them, you'd want to, if they were playing with a verbal idea, then you have to have enough guts to be able to jump in on
and, but you help them. I noticed it with Python when we did the last, in so 2009, we did a reunion in New York, and there were questions being asked. And I just observed, I lay back, and I just saw that everybody would step in if the thing was dying,
right.
And pick it up and go from, it was just like automatic. It wasn't considered, they just step in. And I thought, that's how this thing worked.
Yeah.
We all covered and we all helped.
Yeah, it is. Once you get to a certain level, and it's such a great place to be in, because if you've grown up liking comedy, and then you can get in where you can hang out with people. I mean, I realised that was all you ever wanted. You want respect of the people whose stuff that you liked.
Yeah.
If somebody said, yeah, that's good piece of material, then you just went away.
Do you feel, because, obviously all of you, and then Russell Brand's in the show as well, and, everyone's really... I mean, you guys are... You were talking, you were sort of joking about myth, legend, icon, but, as far as comedy goes, I mean, you guys are all really in the pantheon of great comics, but do you feel that way, or do you feel...
I think it's called pronounced pantheon. You're in the pantheon.
Pantheon.
Where are we going to do this? You have a big compliment coming to you. You turned into transvestite.
Well, that's the other thing. We're good at deflecting praise, aren't we? Comedians are very good at deflecting
praise. Eddie likes it.
All right.
Building upon it.
You're so good.
It's the egotist.
I think a lot of people, especially like aspiring performers, everyone kind of has this idea in their mind, like, oh, if I could just get to this place, if this just happens and everything's going to be amazing, and I see a lot of times people get to that place and they just look empty.
It's not at all what they thought it was going to be. Is it being famous itself? You don't wake up famous. Somebody has to remind you to go, eh, Billy Connolly, oh, it's him, no, it's me.
And that was just his wife.
She's employed to wake me up and go, wake up, you famous!
He added a musical number.
Oh, yeah, but it's also the fame dial can dial up and dial down. You can go to a place where there's a lot of comedy people and you go, hey, it's at this level. You go to a shopping mall and, should you just get out of the way?
I love it. I love it when I'm called. It's like, you know, I love it when you've gone there completely, haven't been on stage, you've done it for ages. It's nice because you're almost back to being anonymous, and then you make a mistake of doing something and it's on again. So I saw you last night on a rerun.
I love being that guy. Hey, you're that guy. That's me. That's me.
You're from that thing.
You're from that thing.
Yeah.
Look, it's that guy. And then they say, what's your name? And you say, Billy Connolly. They say, that's right.
No, I got it right. No, that's not it. No, that's me. No, I don't think that's you.
I was once mistaken for two people, Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor.
That's right.
They had a folk singing double act. This woman said, I know you. You're Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor. I said, I'm both of them.
I'll tell you a great ego
the Harley Orchestra
diminishing thing, which was beautiful, and it shows how my brain plays. They had Jesus Christ Superstar, and it's just gone back on in Britain, and it was playing in arenas, so it was out of Wembley, and I thought, I want to go to this. So I said, can I get a ticket? So you get to the place where you can find out, I just want to go there. I don't need to see it, but I just want to see it. So I get out of Jesus Christ Superstar, see that, and there's a drinks after. Drinks? Okay, I'll go to the drinks. And we sort of wander our way into the drinks. Oh, yeah, you can come in. And then, so that's really nice. And then so we do that, and the drinks and the stuff, and it's the first time it's going back there. And we catch a taxi back. Minicab driver, the guy's Pakistani origin probably, and living in Britain, and drives us in, and we get back into Soho, middle of London, and the guy says, will you be going back to Wembley? And I've played Wembley a number of times, and did the first arena tour there. So and I'm going, yeah, I'll be going back to Wembley. I think you've got to go back to Wembley. I think it's the thing. There comes a time. You can't move off this thing. He says, well, if you're not out too late, here's my card, I'll give you a lift back. Oh, I see. All right. He just wanted to go fair back.
Too many interviews.
I'll be going back to work. Yes, you've got to, haven't you? You've got to, don't you think? I thought, wow, I'm going to do the Pakistani yeah, mate, I think it's nice of you to ask. I will. One has to. It's the way of things.
But do you feel more pressure at the level you guys are at? Where, because, it's like the Seinfeld, the comedian, which is a phenomenal documentary, and Seinfeld saying, like, well, you get like 5 minutes on, you get the fame card for like 5 minutes.
I wouldn't say it was as long as that.
No.
Oh, no, I think it's actually a week.
5 minutes is a long, long time. A minute you get.
Of fame, you say?
No.
When you're on stage,
you get a minute's grace.
Because you're a famous guy. Yeah, and then the joke's better than funny. So how do you at your level work out new stuff? Because you're going to have a process where some stuff's not going to work and people are not as forgiving if they expect you to be at 10 all the time.
I did the thing I stole from... it's work in progress. It's an American idea. Lily Tomlin used to do a lot of work in progress things to work out her new shows, and I thought, that's a good idea. And I got kind of hit from apparently doing old material, because I just used to roll on my new tour. It used to be the old tour that I'd finished, and I'd just start making up new material over the course of the tour. So now and they said, you're not allowed to do that. I said, all right, okay. So now I put work in progress.
Who says you're not allowed to do that? I've done it before.
Well, I was reported to Watchdog, BBC Watchdog, for doing at Birmingham Hippodrome, the first gig of my new tour, of doing things from Dress to Kill. It was now the Circle tour. But that's how I used to do it. I used to tell everyone this. I don't actually write it, like Billy. The style's totally nicked from him. And I just, at the end of the tour on Dress to Kill, I'd start Circle with the same material. But if you come at the end of the tour, if you come at the end of each tour, then you'd always see new material. If you come at the beginning of each tour, you'd always see that. I was trying to get this out to people, but, not everyone hears it. Birmingham Hippodrome says all new material written on it, which I didn't know they were going to do. Some people came, they complained to Watchdog, which is a real... television you know, people, you normally complain that this guy has ripped me off insurance-wise, this company is doing this, this is a faulty vacuum cleaner.
It's like a report, you like, it's like a Better Business Bureau. They're reporting a comedian to a Better Business Bureau.
It really was. A real kick in the head as well, because comedians used to not change the material at all in the old days. Malcolm and Wise, a big double act in Britain, did 30 years the same 1 hour. And so I felt like...
I know Grace Clark and Colin Murray, who did 28 years with the same 8 minutes.
But that's before television. See, the television came on in the late 50s, and it just gobbled up their one act. And what are you going to do next week?
Well, I think...
So that changed things.
I think... Well, I don't think it was actually then, to be honest, because Mortimer Wise continued doing the same one act. They just never did that 1 hour on TV.
Yeah, sure.
What happened in stand-up circuit that I was on was that the late 80s, early 90s, we started changing our material over faster. And so then it became that you had to do that. Mm-hmm. And anyone who'd done stand-up from before that wasn't doing it. Billy was on, had his own... Because he really was the godfather of alternative stand-up. He was the first one doing it when we weren't even doing stand-up. We were doing sketches, and he was doing stand-up. And it was just weird. He just made it all up himself, the whole way of doing it, the conversational way, and he just rotate the show, and we couldn't even do it.
Because I thought that's what other guys were doing.
Really?
Yeah.
But also it wasn't on TV, so you could keep your material for quite a while.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had no interest in television.
Right.
I would go on television and talk about it.
Yes.
Right.
You'd go on Michael Parkinson, that was a great...
Yeah.
Did that feel great when you... Michael Parkinson was a huge... He was like the Billy Rose of Britain. But imagine Billy Rose on Leno show, Letterman show, that kind of audience. So, you know, not a comedian background, but from a journalistic background. And Billy went on famously in the 70s.
Yeah, and I told this joke about a guy... you couldn't tell it today. It was about a guy killing his wife. And
please do.
And how's it go?
And he's in the bar, and he was telling a guy he did it. And the guy said, "What, you shit me?" He said, no. I've buried her in a shed behind the house. And the guy says, "I don't believe you." He said, I'll show you. So he takes him through, and there's a big mound of earth and an ass sticking out of it. His wife's ass sticking out of the mound of earth. And he says, "What's that?" He said, "That's an ass." He says, "Why do you leave it sticking out?" He said, I need somewhere to park my bicycle.
I knew you were going for the bicycle.
Was that a joke that you'd heard, or was that something that
a guy told me on the way to a football match in Spain, in Valencia, and I just leaned against the wall and guffawed. I've never met him again. And I just on the way in the limousine, my manager said, "Now don't, whatever you do, Jimmy, you're always good to these things. Don't tell the joke with the murdered woman and the bum sticking out of the ground." But you can't say that to a comedian, because it just goes straight to the
fan. Well, there are things that happen to you guys all the time. Like, you can't do this, you can't say this, and then you have to figure out ways to get around that.
Not really, they didn't pay any attention to us.
Really?
No, we were under the radar. It was 10:30 at night.
Until you were successful.
Until we were sort of successful, maybe the third series, then they start to look at the scripts and go, "You can't do that, and you can't say that." And then we go and face them, and six of us would come into their little offices, and they would be shit scared. It was really good.
We were the luckiest people on earth when we did it. Or when, now doing it, I'm not speaking about it in the past tense, but the people who were before us in Britain were all censored, officially censored by the Lord Chamberlain. You had to submit your script, and that's where blue comes from. Blue material, blue movies, because the Lord Chamberlain had a blue pencil, and he put it around the bit you couldn't do.
That started when we were at Cambridge doing the Footlights. We had to submit
the script to the Lord Chamberlain. You had to submit it to the Lord Chamberlain.
And they said you cannot say that, because we did this sketch about taking pills, birth control, which was the red pill is for birth control and the green pill is for uncontrolled birth. To tell the difference between these two pills, the red pill has Oni Swaki Molly Ponce tattooed on it so you can see it in the dark. Read it in the dark. Completely absurd, but they would cut out things. You cannot say this, you can't say that. They would be scrubbed out, the Lord Chamberlain. And that was late... That's 63, 64.
Blue material.
Amazing. Well, I love that fact.
You guys have a press conference, but so quickly, I just want to sort of, you know, I seriously could talk to you guys for like 5 fucking hours.
Fuck off.
Really, that is.
That's power.
Yes, and it's in an accent, so it's charming. It's charming here.
It's ethnic.
It's ethnic. It's
cultural.
It's very cultural. You are racist for trying to stop what is happening here.
Do you know your problem?
Seriously.
Do you know your problem?
Listen,
you've got the same attitude as started the Second World War.
That is identical. He's saying what everyone's thinking about your attitude.
That's right. Do I smell burning books?
Look at that.
No, you smell the third smell. That is
a cheese callback.
You just hold a callback.
Long enough.
Even if it doesn't even fit.
So What About Dick is a live show that you did here at the Orpheum. You guys are presenting the show online. People can download the show.
Yep.
$6.
Which has not been done before.
Not really been done before. Not with a thing
Louis
like
C.K.
this.
Louis C.K.
did it a bit.
But
nobody's
done
a play like this. Or a comedy big event like this. And it's December the 13th is Dick Day.
Yeah, and is it November or December?
November the 13th.
November the 13th.
Day.
Yeah,
D-Day.
But D-Day, or B, actually B-Day.
B-Day, I love.
So yes, you can download it. For $6, you get these guys.
Is it whataboutdick.com?
www.whataboutdick.com.
You don't say www.
I'm so sorry. You don't say www.
World War II.
Yeah,
what about Dick?
No, www sounds very 2009.
Oh, so sorry.
And you're Twittering now, so you are a 2012 person.
Am I 2012?
Yeah, you've got the show and everything.
I've tweeted.
Have you?
Do you still
tonight? Yes. I've got 35,000 followers.
Jesus, I've been on 3 weeks and I've got more than that. I mean, really, Billy.
This man is a simple welder. What do you mean? What are you doing to him?
He's a parachute welder. He's a parachute and do some welding.
People shot at him, and then he had to go weld some more. Are you okay?
I'm broken.
Oh, yeah. He's a banjo player. He has no feelings.
Sophie, are you online anywhere? With people?
No. Really? I'm afraid not. I can't cope with it. I don't like the internet. I don't understand it. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter.
You don't have to understand it. You just have to jump
in. I don't want to. I mean, I'll support it for this show.
Oh, but hang on. You don't have to apologize.
I'm stopping it.
She's a reader.
The internet is dumb. Our show is on the internet. And
it's not dumb. I just find it frightening.
It is scary.
It's scary.
So you don't really like technology generally, yeah? Because I've noticed this thing that there's it tends to be women, but it can be men as well, more against technology, but unless it's useful, like car,
and it vibrates.
No, I can't drive. I can't drive at all.
Okay, you're lost.
Yeah.
I tell you something. I'm just back from Mexico fishing. My son is very technical and all that stuff, but he's never worn a watch. On his wrist.
No one wears watches.
And I bought him one for Christmas once, and he made me take it back. He said, "I don't want it." I took it back, but he could tell the time to within. He was never more than 2 minutes wrong.
Really?
When we were fishing. Jimmy, what time is it?
Wow.
23 minutes past two. Wow. 25 after.
Oh, sure, he didn't have a friend up there.
That's incredible. That's amazing.
And I know guys today who do, like Robin Williamson of the Incredible String Band, doesn't drive, never has driven, has no intention of ever driving, and gets through life just dandy. Thank you very much indeed.
I still can't drive, but Los Angeles isn't very funny without a car. It's quite weird. You have to make friends with quite odd people.
And for a city that's so crowded and densely packed, you feel very isolated without a car. You feel like, because you can't walk anywhere in your immediate area that's of any value.
That's the trouble. That's the money people took all the public system out, didn't they? The cars.
Yeah.
They bought the public system and smashed it.
Yeah.
The
story's very well laid out. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? That's exactly.
Is that what it is? Yeah. It's a bad story. It's America gone wrong.
Who is the guy who's the voice of Roger Rabbit?
Charles Fleischer
is one of the best comedians in the world.
He doesn't really perform much anymore. I love him. Yeah. I haven't seen him in ages, and he used to. His mind.
Have you ever seen Charlie Fleischer?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen enough of him. No.
Oh, you will love him.
I think I have seen him. Yeah, he's quite an expressive face.
Yes.
He's a brilliant comic, and he had a lot of math in his stand-up as well.
He had a lot of math in his.
He's a fucking brilliant guy.
Yeah.
They're pulling you guys away. I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For being here. Whataboutdick.com. Eddie Izzard, Eric Idle, Sophie Winkleman, Billy Connolly, whose wife Pamela was my therapist. for many years and got me to quit drinking 9 years ago. Would
she did the same for me.
Isn't it? She's amazing.
Yeah.
She's amazing. Pamela Stevenson, will you please hug her for me?
Of course I will.
And give her a drink.
I'll drink to that.
Enjoy your burritos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.